1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's Talk Radio. This is Your Turn, a live call-in show featuring spirited discussion and debate about issues that matter to the community. Your Turn is sponsored by People's First Community Bank, the best bank in the neighborhood. Stay with us to hear what Northwest Florida thinks. Better yet, call in at 623-1330 and tell us what you think. It's your turn here on 1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's Talk Radio. Now, here's the host of Your Turn.
Good afternoon. My name's Renee Giacchino. I'm corporate counsel for the Center for Individual Freedom, and I'll be your host this afternoon on this version of Your Turn, the program that I've dubbed Meeting Nonsense with Common Sense. I'd like to encourage you to visit our website at www.cfif.org, where you can learn more about the Center for Individual Freedom and how you can sign up for our free lunchtime liberty update. That's www.cfif.org. Well, we're going to start out the program on a very exciting topic. We're going to talk about executive privilege. It's something that's been in the news quite a bit lately, and I've asked Caleb Burns to join me to talk about it. He's an associate at the Washington, D.C. firm of Wiley Rhine. Mr. Burns regularly advises clients on campaign finance, government ethics, and lobbying laws, and I thought he'd be the perfect expert to talk with us about the issue of executive privilege. He's a graduate with his J.D. degree from New York University School of Law. He's a moot court board winner. And he went to college at Duke University. I'm no doubt we have a lot of Duke fans in the audience as well. Caleb, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Renee. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. Can you help me, first of all? I mean, we've been reading, we've been hearing a lot about this term executive privilege. Can you set it up a little bit for us, Caleb?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. And let me start with one caveat. As Renee, you rightly pointed out, I'm an attorney here at the law firm of Wiley Rhine in Washington, D.C. Our firm used to be known as Wiley Rhine and Fielding. The Fielding part was dropped off when Fred Fielding left our law firm to go join the Bush White House as President Bush's counsel. And just so your audience is clear, I have not spoken to Fred about any of these issues. He is, of course, one of the prime drivers in the administration on these issues. So I can't claim any special insight other than what I've learned over my years in dealing with separation of powers issues and related subpoena enforcement issues. So with that caveat, let me at least take a couple of minutes to sort of sketch this out for you and your audience.
Please do.
And separation of powers really here is critical and is the nub of the issue. Executive privilege is not something that is explicitly included in the Constitution. Rather, it's a judicially created doctrine rooted in the Constitution's separation of powers to recognize the primacy of the president and the executive branch of government. That primacy allows the president to receive confidential advice from his advisors, but like everything else, the devil is going to be in the details when we're trying to figure out exactly how to apply this privilege and when the president is properly invoking it. And as I'm sure you can imagine, this becomes increasingly difficult as government has increased in size and there are numerous communications that seem to circulate through the executive branch and through the White House and ultimately become the president's own communications and drive his own decision-making. There are really only a handful of court decisions that give any guidance in this area, and I think that's really a function of one real driver there, too, which is that the government has and the political branches of government have generally reached compromises when these issues have flared up, either for political reasons or because they may be afraid of how the courts might rule. But that said, the courts seem to lay out three factors that ought to be considered when the executive is making an executive privilege claim. The closer the communication is to the president, the better the claim to privilege is going. The better the claim to privilege, communications by the president's top advisors are going to fare much better than those by lower level executive branch employees.
Sure.
The second factor is that the more specific the privilege claim, especially if it's to protect military, diplomatic, or national security deliberations, which are, of course, our core responsibilities of the president, the stronger the privilege claim is going to be. Simply asserting a generalized interest in confidentiality is going to be harder for the president to justify. Then lastly, the privilege can be overcome if there's a demonstrably critical, and that's the language used by the Supreme Court in this area, a demonstrably critical need for the information. The prototype for such a situation would be to investigate allegations of a possible crime where information relating to those allegations is going to be available from no other source. And I think when you take a look at these three factors and apply them to the subpoenas that Congress has issued in connection with the U.S. attorney firings, I think you'll see, at least initially, that the president's claim to executive privilege is going to be relatively strong. First, the subpoenas have been directed to three of the president's top-level advisors, his former political director, his former counsel, and his current chief of staff. Second, the subject matter admittedly doesn't deal with military, diplomatic, or national security matters, but it is a subject matter that's squarely within another of the president's core responsibilities, and that's the selection of political appointees in the executive branch of government. And lastly, in connection with the third criterion, there doesn't, at least to me, appear yet to be a demonstrably critical need for the information that would justify overcoming the executive privilege claim. As you've probably read recently, the House Judiciary Committee just released a report detailing apparent criminal violations that are driving their investigation. Yet when you read certainly the press statements, and I haven't read the report myself, the alleged crimes seem to be based on pretty creative legal theories. And
well,
I suspect this is really just an attempt to dress up the seriousness of the investigation. But more importantly, the information that Congress seems to want, I think, is going to be available from another source, which again would counsel against confronting the executive privilege claim. If you'll recall, a number of months ago, the president, through his counsel, offered to make these individuals available for off-the-record interviews, yet Congress refused to accept that offer. So there, I think, a court might say, well, look, Congress, you had an opportunity to at least conduct some additional investigation. You didn't even avail yourself of that opportunity. Accordingly, you haven't fully justified your claim to pierce the executive privilege claim. So anyway, just to sum up, and I've rambled on long enough here, I know, there are going to be many nuances that drive this debate. These are very broad generalities that I've just described. And it's going to be very interesting to see how this all develops in the coming weeks and months.
Well, I mean, that's very helpful laying it out that way. I mean, especially, when you talk about the three different factors that any court will consider. Let me go to the third one that you talked about, demonstrably critical need. Now, at the beginning part of what you said there, you said as it may relate to, proving a crime or something like that. Do you think Congress, the ramblings that I'm hearing is that it's very likely that they may pursue some sort of charges against Gonzalez as it may relate to perjury or something like that. Would that be the grounds that they would then use to try and, fit that third criteria that you suggested, or the third factor, demonstrably critical need?
Well, the Gonzalez situation is slightly different in that the Attorney General, people are now saying, and Democrats on the Hill in particular are saying, that the Attorney General hasn't been fully truthful with what he has reported to Congress vis-a-vis the NSA warrantless wiretap program that has been
completely
really
front
page news for a while there. But that is, again, it's these types of I don't want to call them non-substantive crimes because they are crimes and they're certainly serious. But for example, in I had read in a press report, the House is claiming that it is investigating possible obstruction of justice charges. Well, that claim is so attenuated because the way that theory would work, as I understand it, at least, the claim would be that a U.S. attorney was removed because he or she was conducting an investigation that the administration disapproved of. Well, that seems to be a non-starter, given the fact that it's been widely reported that Karl Rove and the other advisors had suggested that they remove all 91 of the U.S. attorneys.
Well,
so,
isn't that within the purview?
That's what I'm getting at when I say, I think they're trying to manufacture claims that this is really a serious matter that's within the core responsibility of the Congress to investigate. I'm not so sure they've done a terribly good job to justify that.
And that's what's so interesting to me is it's my understanding, and you mentioned this early on, that these are political appointments, and people serve, it's my understanding, at the whim in those positions of the president.
That is 100% accurate, and that's the first thing I thought of when this story first broke. And I thought, how is this even newsworthy? It's really now just a political witch hunt. It's, you know, how can anyone claim that there is a violation of the law here? Well, the Democrats on the Hill have gotten quite creative in trying to come up with apparent legal violations in order to justify their investigation and presumably to ultimately overcome a claim of executive privilege here. Just to add a little more color to that point, Renee, traditionally, the U.S. attorneys they are all political appointees, and at the end of each administration, my understanding has been that they all submit their resignations
right.
and allow the new president to appoint all 91 of the new U.S. attorneys. What hasn't happened in the past is wholesale removal of all of them. And while that idea was floated within the administration, they ultimately decided against that and selected a handful of U.S. attorneys to remove. But it seems to me that is fully within the president's prerogative. They are political appointees. And short of a legitimate crime being committed here, I don't at this point, you know, again, with the caveat that I only know what I've read in the newspapers.
Right.
I'm not sure the congressional Democrats have enough here to justify this other than treating it as a political witch hunt.
In a second, I want to get to, kind of the steps of how you anticipate this may play out. Will there be a lawsuit that's filed? But before we do that, as I had hoped and as I expected, actually, the lines are lit up with callers. Can we take some calls?
Sure.
Okay, go ahead. Mark, it's your turn. You there,
Hello?
Mark? Hi, Mark. Thanks for calling in. It's your turn.
I just wanted to tell you that I would really hate to lose you on Pensacola Radio because I love to listen to you, but you're way out of your league. You should be up there with Rush Limbaugh. You should be on a national venue. Your voice is so fabulous and your intelligence is so incisive.
Are you going to stop by so I can pay you for saying that? I'm blushing. You can ask Mallory. Thank you.
I'm sure that you have a lot of people who are calling to tell you this, but I mean, like I said, I would hate to lose you here, but I want to hear you on a bigger venue. You're worth it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I really do. I appreciate that. And it makes all the hard work that I put in. And thank you for noticing. I appreciate that very much, Mark.
Okay.
All right. Have you got a question for Caleb? Because
that's all I had.
Oh,
I've listened for several weeks, and I'm just flabbergasted that someone of your caliber is on a small, station like this.
Well, we're growing, and stay with us. We'll keep growing. And again, thank you very much for the call and the compliment. I so appreciate it, and I'll be back again in 2 weeks. But we got 2 hours left. Lots of fun. So thanks, Mark, for the call.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Ron. It's your turn.
Well, thank you, Renee. I guess you're still talking to us low underlings down here in the low lake. I don't know.
Could someone bring me coffee? I can't even get coffee. No, just kidding. Go on, Ron. It's your turn.
I got a question for Caleb. Let's go all the way back to the beginning of the separation issue. And I believe you made the comment that there is no constitutional right for a separation between, for executive privilege, correct?
Well, there's no specific allowance in the Constitution that says the president has a quote-unquote executive privilege. The privilege has grown out of the fact that the Constitution is structured in such a way that due respect must be paid to each individual branch of government, and the executive privilege doctrine grows out of the respect that ought to be paid to the executive branch.
Right, and this is a judicial separation. It's not a constitutional separation. So my question is, and I think the Constitution is very clear, that if it's not specifically allowed or specifically prohibited in the Constitution, then that privilege and right does not exist, period. Anything other than that would fall to the states or to the people. So there's actually no basis for even a judicial separation of the powers.
Well, you raise an interesting point, and what you're really getting at, it seems, are much larger and bigger issues of constitutional interpretation. And if there isn't a prerogative that's explicitly spelled out in the Constitution, does that prerogative exist? The Supreme Court has recognized this as a natural outgrowth of how the Constitution is structured. So the law of the land as it stands today is that this does exist, but you raise it you raise a very interesting point, and a point that unfortunately would take much more time than the 20 minutes we have left, at least with my appearance, to unpack.
And Ron, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I like the purist view that you've adopted, and I very much agree with it. But I do think, you know, as Caleb has pointed out, history precedent seems to be certainly more in favor of the position that the White House is taking, considering the fact that the Supreme Court first upheld the practice of executive privilege, I think, back in the early 1800s.
Right.
And even some of the documentation on this goes back as far as George Washington and Thomas Jefferson invoking the privileges during their administrations. Again, they did it, as Caleb mentioned, under the auspice of the separation of powers doctrine. But, I mean, there are other provisions and nuances that we've talked about on this program, and unfortunately they all escape me right now. My head's still up in the clouds from Mark's comments, where, you know, we come in the back door on our constitutional privileges and rights, even the right of privacy. You know, I mean, that's, I guess, the best example. I mean, that is not explicitly stated, right, Caleb?
And, that's exactly right.
But I mean, I'll stand here, you know, till I'm blue in the face and proclaim that we have a constitutional right to privilege. Right to privacy.
And you're telling me that we don't have an amendment that does that?
Well, it doesn't say it in the purest of language.
Secure seems to be private to me.
I'm sorry?
The word secure seems to be private to me.
That's a good, absolutely good interpretation. And I think that's what a lot of this is, too. Ron and Caleb, I'm going to have to take a break. Caleb, no, you can stay on. You can. Okay. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We've got someone else on hold when we come back, and we're going to continue to talk with Caleb Burns. He's an attorney with the firm of Wiley Ryan, and we're talking about the executive privilege. Please stay tuned.
Now, back to your turn on 1330 WEBY, Northwest Florida's Talk Radio. The phone lines are open, so call in and join the conversation at 623-1330.
Okay, we're talking about the executive privilege. It's obviously a very, very hot issue today as the White House announced that the president had invoked the executive privilege with respect to the documents and potential testimony that they've asked for from folks such as Harriet Myers and Chief of Staff Joshua Bolton and others. And we are talking with Caleb Burns. He's with the law firm of Wiley Ryan out of Washington, D.C. And Mark, you've got a question. Go ahead. It's your turn.
Hey, thanks for taking my call,
sure.
Renee.
My pleasure.
I'd like to ask your guest, isn't it true that President Bush used executive privilege earlier in his first term to protect former President Clinton under one of the Reno investigations? Isn't that so?
There, I'm vaguely familiar with what you're referring to. My recollection is that there was a request for records that were compiled during the Clinton presidency, and that President Bush had resisted providing those records based on executive privilege-like issues, and I'm being intentionally squishy here because executive privilege. There are other doctrines that sound like executive privilege, but don't quite qualify technically as an invocation of executive privilege of the type we're discussing today. But you're correct that the president has been consistent, even with the man who beat his father. And protecting the executive's prerogative to maintain the confidentiality of executive branch deliberations.
It's clear to me that the Democrats, Conyers and so on, that want to at least attempt or use the threat of impeachment, will get nowhere unless they remove the president's friend, the attorney general. And then they'll have, since they own the Senate, they will be able to negotiate somebody to replace him that they may be able to coerce or persuade into getting appointing an independent counsel. Do you agree?
Well, you know, ultimately, the person who's driving all this is the President of the United States. So with or without Attorney General Gonzalez, the president has staked out this very strong claim to executive branch confidentiality, and he doesn't appear to be backing off of it. So I'm not sure. I'm not sure that gets the Democrats where they need to be in connection with this particular issue.
Well, that's the stance that the president should have taken with Fitzgerald, don't you think? He should have never appointed Fitzgerald as an independent counsel.
Yeah, and there are so many variables with that decision and political considerations that again, and I know I've already said this once in the half hour. That's got to be another topic for another time.
Well, I guess I did. My last final comment is one of my criticisms of the president. Is you have to understand what your environment is, and he seems to, I know he's smart enough to know where he's at, but he seems to be in denial.
Yeah, and it really begs the question, you know, can there be a compromise? I mean, I would think the White House thinks, oh, yeah, they'll come around, but I think you're absolutely right, Mike. I don't know that he really sees the environment that's in front of him, and I'm not sure this time that there will be a compromise. I think you're absolutely right on that. Caleb, we've got about 30 seconds left. Mark, if you've got something else, otherwise I want Caleb to just walk us through where this is going to go. You there?
Well, I'll take you up on your invitation, Renee. It sounds like he dropped off.
Yeah, he may have.
Where things stand now is quite interesting. Generally speaking, the way the process works is that the House would have to vote a contempt of for would have to vote.
Hey, Caleb,
that
unfortunately,
the individuals are found in contempt of Congress, and
Caleb,
that contempt citation would then be enforced by the United States Attorney.